Welcome to the Touring Car America Podcast. Where touring car racing comes to life. You'll get in-depth interviews with drivers, series officials, auto manufacturer reps, and unique personalities through SRO, America's Touring Car Division. This is the Touring Car America Podcast, and this is Joe Jordan.
Welcome once again to the 13th episode of the TC America Podcast. Going to be a little bit of an unusual one because we're going to be talking today with Will Rogers, who was a TCB racer with us a few years ago in 2016. And since then, he's went straight from TCB to NASCAR K&N series. And I've been lucky enough, both Jim, my brother Jim Jordan, and I were around when he was first started road racing on pavement. And we were around for the early years, and I've been working with him ever since. So it's a pretty interesting story from a real hardworking young guy who doesn't come with a golden spoon, who has to chase every dollar, every partnership he can. But it's a very interesting interview. It's about an hour long. So I don't have any other stuff in there this week. I don't have this week in the series as we get ready to go to Watkins Glen. We're a week out. A week from now, we'll be testing at Watkins Glen. So some cool new stuff coming out there. I'm excited to see it. I will let everyone know that we'll be on a different channel this week on Sirius XM. We'll be on channel 385 on both Saturday and Sunday for all the SRO races. So Gino Carini and I will be doing the play-by-play for that, and we hope you listen in on Sirius XM. Also, you know, the series still has tickets available. Weather looks like it's going to be perfect. It's a beautiful, picturesque place, one of my favorite places to go because there's just so much history, so much beauty, and, you know, it's in a quiet little part of upstate New York, but it's really not that far from major metropolitan areas. So if you have the opportunity, we'd love to see you. If you see me wandering around, I'm the fat old guy with gray hair. That might not narrow it down for most, but feel free to, if you think it's me, introduce yourself. I'd love to talk to you. If you listen to the podcast, I'm really overwhelmed with how many people actually listen and participate. So again, thank you so much for that. And I love touring cars, and I love Touring Car America, and I'm so happy to be able to give you some insights on the drivers and the teams and the manufacturers that are participating. So without further ado, we'll go right into the interview with Will Rogers. Thank you very much. Corksport Performance is your Mazdaholic stop for performance parts. Since 1998, Corksport has been giving love to all the ignored Mazda models which everyone drives. 20 years later, Corksport is a leader in manufacturing a full range of performance parts for the Mazda Speed 3, the Mazda 3, the ND MX-5, and more. We have real people that will take your phone call, none of that email-only BS from online-only stores, or a store being run out of their mom's basement in Detroit by a guy named Chuck. Corksport supports simple bolt-on mods, giving you guidance and advice to build your Mazda Speed 3 to over 600 horsepower and be a terror on the track. This is a TC America podcast, and I'm here with Will Rogers, who is a touring car B-Spec driver with us a few years ago and is now an Xfinity driver in NASCAR. Will, I'm glad you're here. We just got back, both of us. I was lucky enough to be your spotter, one of your spotters at Mid-Ohio. It was great to be with you at a racetrack again, and thanks for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, same to you, Joe. Really appreciate it, and thanks for having me on.
So, Will, I know a ton about you, but I know that a lot of people don't. I want to get back to the early years and who you are. I know that you're the oldest of three kids. Your parents are very involved with your racing. Talk about your family a little bit and how you fit in with your family and how they're all a part of who you are.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you know, when it comes to my family, I'm very, very lucky to have a great support system behind me. My parents as you know, Joe, are probably some of the biggest racing junkies out there. No matter what it is, they're always consuming it racing-wise. Actually, I've found that my mom likes to watch racing maybe even more than I do. She's up late some nights watching V8 Supercars in Australia, and she's telling me about it the next day. So it's pretty neat that that my parents are so immersed. But they've been behind me every single step of the way. Even though they're really, you know, their whole lifetime growing up, they weren't involved in racing at all. I'm a completely first-generation racer. So when I was 8 years old, I was introduced to go-karts. My mom was actually the one that got me into it, funny enough. And here we are, 16 years later, going through all the ranks, including touring car, and now racing Xfinity Series.
And one thing I do know is I really enjoy your younger brother and your younger sister, but they don't enjoy racing. I think you've ruined it for them. Talk about that a little bit.
I've definitely ruined racing for my siblings. You know, they definitely support what I do, and they know exactly what we're doing, but I think because of that, they're too smart to get involved. They've seen the ups and downs and the roller coaster that I've gone through, my parents have gone through, as far as trying to make a career happen in racing. So they're too smart for that. They're like, you know what, we're not going to spend any time, you know, just pretty much falling over yourself every step of the way trying to figure it out. But they're always great. My sister's got her passion. She travels the world. She's a huge part of the church and really helps inspire young people to find their path and their inspiration. My brother, he's still really developing who he is, and we've all gone through struggles and things, but I know he's a fighter, and he's trying to figure out who he is as a person at the moment. But they're always there watching, just maybe not at the racetrack.
Yeah, with your younger brother, he's still in high school, so I think we're all trying to figure out who the heck we are in high school, that's for sure. So
exactly.
You were 8 years old, and you were born and growing up in Maui, and I think the story goes is that one of your schoolmates, classmates, had a go-kart, and that interested you. Is that how it all started?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, well, when I turned eight, like I guess many eight-year-olds, or up until 8 years old, I dabbled in different kinds of sports, from, you know, t-ball to football, golf. Being that I grew up in Maui, obviously always went to the beach and was surfing and windsurfing and things like that. But nothing really grasped my attention until we found go-karting. And yeah, I had two classmates that year that showed up once a week, or their dad showed up once a week to pick them up after school with parts in the back of his truck. And we saw that for some time, and Mom finally saw him on a class field trip where parents were chaperoning and said, hey, what are those things in the back of your truck and what do you guys go do every week? And turned out to be real legitimate go-kart that you race on the weekends in the what was the IKF at the time. So a week later, he invited us down to go-kart track, and a year later, I won my first championship. And I guess I was the whole 2005 Hawaii State champion. So Steve Egger was his name. He is the father of the two classmates that got me into it, and he became a mentor of mine and my parents. A few nights a week after school, we'd go over to his house and build go-karts, rebuild motors, figure out how to set it all up and really do it ourselves. He was a guy that guided us, you know, in the right direction, but never did anything for us. He wanted to make sure that my dad and I understood motorsport through and how to be successful at the racetrack every weekend on our own. So that's kind of how it all started. And again, believe it or not, there is go-kart or racing lifestyle on the island of Maui. And if you look hard enough, you can find it.
That's great. So you moved to Southern California. Your dad was an artist and a teacher, correct? So he moved to Southern California, and you ended up in Marriott. Is that the next stage of your life after Hawaii?
Yep. And actually, you know, both my parents, their professions, my mom, by trade, is a clinical social worker and has been for 25 years. She was also a professor out at Columbia in New York City. And my dad was a professional artist and had art schools out in Hawaii and full of art and That was probably the perfect combination of parents for a race car driving son. I like to joke. two people that have clearly no idea about racing or the financial support to support racing, but somehow it came together. And shortly after we won our first championship on Maui, my dad and my mom had work opportunities in Southern California, and that just happened to be one of the biggest places for go-karting in the country, which was Region 7 of the IKF. A lot of young talent came out of there, from guys that have gone into IndyCar, Flipstar Racing, NASCAR, for life. So it was kind of just a perfect time and a perfect place for us to relocate to. And yeah, we ended up in Murrieta, California. We were there for about 11 years. That's where I did a lot of go-kart racing, then transitioned to motocross, off-road, and then Flipstar Racing. So that was a huge move for us.
Yeah, and I know that you did go-karting for a while, and then you moved into motocross. Talk about that. What made you go to motocross from go-karts?
Well, like a lot of young guys getting into racing that don't have a ton of financial support, we ended up running out of money. We raced the Region 7 IKF for about 2 years, I think, and kind of just blew our wad doing that and realized, oh, crap, we can't move forward, we can't continue. So I think I took a brief hiatus from racing, maybe 3 to 5 months, something like that. And before you know it, I made new friends in a new school who just happened to race motocross. And these were guys that were actually really good, ascending the ladder to become pros. And I got to go to the track and kind of fell in love with motocross. And probably within a few weeks later, we got a new bike and started to make that progression with those new buddies of mine. So I ended up racing motocross for about 5 years, going all the way from the 65cc class up to the 250cc class. I was never that great. I was more or less a C-class rider. I wasn't really willing to put my body on the line like others, but I had a heck of a time doing it and learned a ton about racing, a ton about racing culture, its people, and how the industry works. And, of course, learning how to be extremely aggressive on the racetrack. So I took a lot from transitioning to motocross.
And from there, that was about the time when side-by-sides were starting to come out, UTVs, and I know that you transitioned into running some of the first UTV short course racing. Talk about that a little bit and how you came across UTV racing, and you're still doing that today, but talk about the beginning of that.
Yeah, I mean, after racing motocross for a while, just getting to know a lot of people and understanding a little bit more of that off-road lifestyle or culture and people, was introduced to UTV racing, and it was super appealing to me because, you know, that was my opportunity to get back behind the wheel, get in a cage, and not put my body on the line as much, but still be very competitive. So, you know, I had seen the Rhinos, like the Yamaha Rhinos being raced for years, and the technology was finally advancing in side-by-sides where these things could handle almost any terrain, and it wasn't the point where you launch it off a jump and you break your back kind of thing by landing. They were actually purpose-built race cars, and I ended up making the decision one week and saying to my parents, I'm going to give this a shot. You know, I can't go any farther in motocross, so what do I have to do to make this happen? So between my parents and I, we financed the Polaris Razor, and I started racing in the Works Championship and the Dirt Series Championship in California, I believe. Did that for a little bit of time and realized that I wanted to go a little bit farther in the side-by-side space. Transitioned to a more professional-looking team in the Lucas Oil Off-Road Championship and raced in the Regional Series in the 900 class and got some really good experience there, got some pretty good finishes, and kind of just showed what I was capable of behind the wheel in off-road racing. And that's kind of ultimately where that ended, because shortly after I found full-star racing and made the transition to that, but that's kind of how my off-road career went.
So it also started your video career, too. So what a lot of people probably don't know is how talented you are at putting together videos and those. And you, I don't know how much you do it anymore, but you worked for Mad Media for a while, who's a big name now in the industry. But you were there when they were first starting out, the Marcelli Brothers, and talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, actually, that stemmed back to my early days in motocross because, you know, again, we ran out of money racing go-karts, so I had to figure out a way to, you know, in part finance some of my racing, even though it was a lot cheaper than go-kart racing. So, you know, one day, sitting at the motocross track, I picked up my iPhone 3 Plus, I think is what it was, and filmed my buddy and put together a 30 to 45 second clip. And he loved it. He posted it on social media, and he gave me, like, $50 for it. And I was like, wait a minute. I could film people, make a short little video, and actually make money? So, you know, progressing on, maybe about a year from then, I ended up buying an upgraded camera, and I made that my part-time business. When I wasn't racing, I was making money in racing, filming others doing their thing, and that steadily progressed over the years throughout the motocross career, off-road, and then sports cars where, yeah, I did get to work with guys like the Marcelli Bros at Bad Media and go do some really extraordinary things on the film side. Always really directed around action sports, which was really cool. It kept my attention in it and my interest. So we got to go film at places like Pike Peak International, Hillfine, so Red Bull. We did a lot of pieces for Polaris and a lot of other clients that Mad Media had. Got to travel to several different countries, which was really neat, and get a ton of experience that way. But that was really how I funded a lot of the racing that I was able to do early in my career.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, I was around when you were probably 3 or 4 years into doing the videos, and I just remember being shocked, you being so young, but really knowing that part of the business very well. So it was fun for me. And I know that you said, yeah, you got into sports car. You started doing track days is what I think happened, right? Is that where you started? You went out to like Willow Springs or Button Willow or someplace like that to do track days?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, during the time of racing off-road, although we had a ton of fun and made a lot of connections and developed a lot of my career in that space, we quickly realized that off-road racing, at least at the time, didn't have a future. It really had a ceiling that was pretty low for guys like me. So we, you know, my dad and I and my mom, we sat down a few times and we talked about what the direction it was that we wanted to take because, you know, me being a young guy and a guy that's never wanted to be or never going to be, I hope, one of the shoulda, coulda, woulda people. I can't look back in life and say that I didn't give something a shot because I just regret it. So we sat down and talked about what direction we wanted to head. And obviously, coming from go-karting at an early age, I was very familiar and very comfortable with racing on the pavement. So we did some analysis and figured, you know, why don't we just buy a car that's relatively track-ready and just go get some seat time and explore what the options are. And, Joe, I'm sure you'll agree with me on this, but I think we made a terrible decision in the car that we purchased and the way that we went about it. However, it was what led us to working with you and your family and getting into the proper place within sports car racing. But to shed a little light on that story, we ended up buying a Subaru STI right off the showroom floor. One, because it was a cool car, and then two, it had a little bit of power in it. It was a performance-driven car, easily modified and all of those things. So quickly, we took it to a track day at Fontana, and we went to, I think, 4 track days following that, including places like Willow Springs, Spring Mountain, Button Willow. And by the time we got to Button Willow, which was our 5th race in, we had a lot of modifications on the car because Dad got a little excited and wanted to just make it faster and make me, you know, more experienced with a more performance car, I guess you could say. And lo and behold, too many motor modifications happened and we blew the thing up. And we were stranded at Button Willow on a Saturday morning, and we were pretty much at a loss for words. We didn't know what to do next. We just so happened to meet some people, actually Peter Hoagland, to call him out specifically. We met him in the paddock and said, "Hey man, do you know anybody that needs a trailer, or that has a trailer that could take our car back to Marietta? We need some help." And we asked around, and we finally stumbled upon you guys, Joe, the Jordan family, and you were very gracious in saying that, you know, "Yeah, guys, we'll take your car back. We live in Baldwin. We'll pass them right through, so why not?" And Joe, your brother Jim, said, "You know, hey man, you guys already paid for the weekend. We've got an extra Miata in the trailer, so why don't you give it a shot?" And a few sessions later, you guys knew it maybe even before I did, but I was hooked. We knew that Spec Miata was the right place to be, and that's kind of how I got back on the pavement from the off-road days.
Yeah, it's a very kind of classic story that we tell almost every time we see each other. People are listening to us. Will and his dad, unfortunately, it was a hot day out of Button Willow, 100-something degrees. You know, I think it was August. And we were there running a Spec Miata race with my son, Joey. And, yeah, Will, they were looking for a way to get their car home, so we got introduced, and then one thing it led to another, and you're driving one of our cars, and we kind of knew that you showed some speed for a guy who hadn't been out there before, and we're like, you know, we're building this new car, maybe this is something that he could be interested in and doing. And we, at the end of the day on Sunday, so it was 2 days worth of running that other Spec Miata around, we put him in our primary Spec Miata and said, "Hey, give this car a shot and tell us what you think." And yeah, poor Will was hooked. It became the focus of his life, his dad's life, everyone's life. So we brought that broken Subaru home, and your mom likes to tease that thing sat in the garage for a while. You also had your UTV in there, and you sold the UTV, I think, to fund as much Spec Miata racing that you could do. And we spent a year of you running with us with my son, and you know, you going out behind my son every session, and you know, him, you know, talking you through it and helping you through. And by the end, I'll never forget, we went out to Colorado to run a couple of teen Mazda Challenge races because we were trying to clinch a championship. And I'll never forget, at Pueblo, you were as fast as he was and did extremely well. You practically destroyed the car to be as fast as you were, but you were there. You know what I mean? At that point on, you understood what it was going to take and what you had to do. And, you know, from my past experience, having developed young drivers and some people along the way, I knew you were going to be great, and I knew it was going to be good for you. You actually bought that car that we built and ran that the next year and did very well in the Teen Mazda Challenge. I think you tied in the championship with Mason Filippi. Is that right?
Yep, I think so.
Yeah, anyway, you guys battled all year, and I think most of the people know that he's won some of the TCR races this year in our class. After that, we had run my son in TCB and done extremely well, won four of the last five races in 2015. And you saw that, and you were trying to figure out what to do next. You decided, well, the cars are reasonable enough, I'm going to go give this a shot. So you ran, I want to say, five or six races in TCB. Is that correct? Something like that?
Yes. Something like that. It might have been four weekends, so eight races.
Yeah, and you won, I think, about half of them. Is that about correct?
Yeah, I won six out of eight, from what I remember.
Yeah, you won a bunch of races in it. And, you know, we were there helping you along with Hale Motorsports. Get you know, you and Henry Morse were part of, you know, Jim and I's tutelage. And you guys both won races and did well. And you know, I remember having discussions with you, and I said to you, is that, you know, there's not many places you can go anymore in racing that you don't have to carry a huge checkbook with you. If it was me, right. I can remember having the conversation with you. I said, if it was me, I would look at, you know, K&N racing. I would look at NASCAR, because at least there's some hope that a talented kid can still make it. And amazingly enough, you kind of listened to me, I think.
Well, amazingly enough, I think we listened to you a ton, Joe. between everything and yeah, I mean, if it wasn't for you guys in the Specnyata division helping me develop, I certainly wouldn't have what I call finding or flicking the light switch as soon as I did. And I'm very thankful to be able to run with Joey and with you guys to figure that out quickly, because I know for some people it takes a while to get to that point. Even for some people it takes years, and I'm just happy that our result, you know, came quickly. And transitioning the touring car, it was a great experience. Finally got some professional experience under my belt, and I think we technically, I'm still counting this as a win, but for our first weekend at Circuit of the Americas, I think I swept it. So the first race, if anybody looks back, technically I just got disqualified because I think we had 0.3 or 0.4 of a degree, too much negative camber from smacking one of those little red curbs. But still, I hold that as a win for my record. And, you know, with that experience, yeah, I got to experience the pro ranks and really try to figure out where we could go. And yeah, unfortunately, just at least at that time, and I'm not too familiar with what the landscape is right now, though, but NASCAR did kind of seem like the best opportunity for us. So I took the leap, and through some connections of mine that I made throughout the years, found a team that was based in Idaho that had K&N cars available that we could go race for a pretty small amount of money and figured out how to wrangle together every penny to do it, and not without any drama in the mix at all, but we had six races that we were able to accomplish with that team, and it was very much a backmarker team, a group that really just provides guys opportunity to get their feet wet in the series, and if they're able to, or if they have the drive to move up, they do. So that's kind of what I did. I did those six races, and I think three of them were road courses, three of them were circle tracks. What's funny enough is my first circle track race ever was at State Line Speedway in Idaho, and that's a little quarter-mile boring, not very much banking, but really tight quarters racing, you could say. And my next circle track race was Iowa Speedway, which for the K&N series is kind of like the biggest track. And it's a mile in length, about 160 miles an hour down the front stretch, and there are four grooves that you can use to race. So I really got thrown to the wolves when it came to making my stock car transition. But it was all for the better, I guess you could say, because in 2017, I was fortunate enough to move up and compete with a pretty great team in Jefferson Pitts Racing for the 2017 K&N West Championship, where I ended up winning two races on the East Coast, where we came out and wanted to get our feet wet, you know, at least in this part of the country. And I didn't win in the West. However, I had one or two second places that year and a bunch of top fives and top tens, where even though I didn't grow up as a circle track guy, and those were some of my first circle track races, we still showed a lot of progress and a lot of potential for what my career would be later on and up until this day.
Yeah, and going back, so I think I want to say it was 2016 when you started with that entry-level K&N team, and you were kind of doing both TCB and K&N kind of in the same year. I always think it's, you know, I preached something to you back when you're running spec Miatas, and I said, look, if you can run quick in a spec Miata and win races, you can do it in anything. So here you are. You went from a 100 horsepower front wheel drive car to how much horsepower does a K&N car have?
630.
Yeah, to a 630 horsepower, 3,000 pound stock car. It did amazingly well. And I think that first year I was with you at Utah Motorsports Complex, where we got a top five, which was, I think, the best finish for that team in years, something like that.
Yeah.
So,
I can't remember exactly where we finished, but that, you know, it was definitely good for them and good for me to show that even though the equipment wasn't, you know, always capable of doing that, I was able to influence them a little bit, and and improve it. And I think a lot of people saw that.
So I don't think most people would believe you went from a 100 horsepower front wheel drive car to a stock car. Talk about that a little bit. What was that transition like?
It's hard to believe, for sure. I mean, when it comes to sports car racing, the trajectory of most drivers, they go from something like a go-kart, maybe up to a Miata, and then they steadily keep rising the rank. You know, every car they jump in maybe has an extra 100 horsepower, maybe an extra couple hundred pounds, something like that. But for me to make that super huge transition, pretty much jump off the edge and just say, sure, I'm going to give this thing a shot. Most people would think the transition was really rough, but I don't think it was, like you were saying, Joe. Because of what I learned in the Miata and in the B-Sec car, I was able to take everything from that and apply it to a stock car in every single way except for, you know, me understanding that this car has a lot more power, the tires don't work as well, and there's a lot of weight behind it. So everything worked out just fine as long as I kept it in the right perspective, you could say.
Yeah, and I just think that's an interesting, again, I don't think many people make that transition like you did. And I'm going to jump ahead a little bit, but we were at Mid-Ohio last weekend, and Patrick Gallagher, who's MX-5 Cup champion, he ran in GS and IMSA and Mustangs, has done all sorts of stuff. He came and sought out advice from you. And I thought that was, smart of Patrick, but what was the advice that you gave him about driving that stock car for the first time?
To be honest, I think I gave him some more advice than what I'll say now, but it was such a whirlwind of the weekend. I can't remember exactly what I told him.
Okay,
but
you told me.
I'm pretty sure I told him, hey, man, drive it like a Miata with more power, less tire, more weight.
Yeah,
I don't know exactly where he finished, but I hope that helped him a little bit. But that's pretty much the way that I approach it. And I think that because I approach it that way, especially on the road courses, that's why I'm a standout road course guy in stock cars. I'm not trying to drive it like a football track, and I'm trying to just drive it for what it is, you know, but also maximizing myself and the surface and the racetrack that I learned in that lower horsepower, smaller car, and that's why I think we have great finishes, wins, and runs with guys like Cup Series champs Kevin Harvick and other Cup drivers who have been in this sport a lot longer than I have.
Yeah, and that was a great transition because you mentioned you finished second in the West in a few events, but I think the turning point was when you finished second at Sonoma in front of all the Cup teams. And you battled with a guy, and I won't say it yet, but you battled with him hammer and tongs the whole way, you know, rubbing on each other. You probably could have taken him out, but you chose not to because you just knew it wasn't right. And you finished second to Kevin Harvick, who immediately respected you for how you drove, and you didn't take him out. And he really helped you kind of get some confidence and introduce you around. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think a lot of that race, again, stemmed from the second-out experience that I had, and not only in the way that I drove the car, but in the way that I perceived the race, tried to make sure everything went the way that I needed it to go, but then also thinking about the longevity. You know, I think a lot of people in stock car racing specifically live from race to race, and it's very much a reactive kind of environment for them or situation, and I wanted to be proactive. I wanted to anticipate, you know, not only what was happening during the race, but then what was going to happen for years to come, because, you know, running behind a guy like Kevin Harvick, not only being teammates with him, but then also having this chance to beat him, whether it was going to be passing him cleanly or moving him, those are going to be two different, completely different outcomes, because Kevin is probably one of the most respected guys in the garage, especially when it comes to speaking his mind. Because when he speaks his mind, whether it's positive or negative, people listen to him. There are not a lot of guys that have that kind of impact that Kevin does. And I thought about that during the race, and I knew that probably the best way I was, probably the most effective way I was going to pass him was going to be having to move him. And I decided, you know what? It's not worth it for Kevin to get out of the car, disrespect me in any way, and then also just hurt my reputation. So I bit the bullet. I did not move him in turn 11 on the last lap. And when he got out of the car, it went exactly the way that I was anticipating, and it's paid dividends ever since. So I think that that's something that I took from my sports car racing background, not only showing that respect, but then, you know, receiving that respect for you know, paid dues, stuff like that. So that's kind of how that went down, but it was really neat to get out there and beat a lot of those tough guys, not only in 2017, but then also 2018, where we went back and ended up winning the Sonoma race. So, that experience was definitely a huge turning point in my career.
Yeah, it was, you know, that 2018, you went and you didn't run a full season, but you ran a bunch of different races. And on Kevin Harvick's advice, he said you need to win. So you got to pick the races that you can win and try to go win some races and build your name. And one thing about that race in 2018 is there was five Cup regulars there and some up-and-coming guys like Alex Bowman, like the Liberty guy, I can't think of his William Byron, Eric Almirola, all those guys that were going to run in the K&N series with you, and they immediately had respect for you because of what happened the year before. So, and I know they were coming to you for advice on the track and how to drive, and then you just took it to them, and that, again, just raised your reputation. So how was that for you to have, I often wonder if they knew your background being Spec Miata and B-Spec and those kind of things. If they knew that background, do you think they would have come and asked you for advice? I think they probably would have, because it really doesn't matter. They know how fast you are. But what was that like to have those kind of guys come and talk to you and get advice from you?
I think, and I want to be measured in what I say. It was a very good thing. I mean, you know, I'm very humbled, I guess, to think that these Cup guys, including really accomplished Cup guys, coming to me for advice and having that respect. It means a lot. It means that what I've done so far has been a waste. You know, it means that all the hard work that not only myself but everybody who's behind me has put into this, it clearly says that, all right, we're doing the right things and we're on the right path. And again, it's not for nothing. So it was really neat. And being teammates with a guy like William Byron, too, really, really good young guy who obviously is at the peak of his career right now, and it's going to be continuing to go up and up. But being able to work with him one-on-one, and you know, what's funny is I gave him some advice to turn 11 during that practice before the 2018 race, and he instantly picked up about 3/10. And at that point, I was like, all right, I'm done. No more helping anybody, because I can't screw my own race here. But he ended up running a really great race. I think he finished third, and Eric Almirola finished second behind me. But it was neat to go to Victory Lane there after that win and have guys like William and Eric Almirola come to Victory Lane and congratulate me. It was really gratifying, I guess you could say, to have that happen.
Yeah, and I know that you say you wouldn't help him, but I also know you well enough to know that if he came over and asked you again something else, you would give him the information, because that's the type of guy that you are. You don't want to mess up your own race, but at the same time, you're always there for people. I've never, ever seen you not help someone when they've asked for your help, and I admire that about you.
Thank you, and that's something I get from you, Joe. I mean, you guys were, in fact, not, at least from what I remember, always the ones that everybody had an eye on, whether it was fear or just knowing that you were probably going to go whoop their ass no matter where you were. Not necessarily that you were going to share with the world everything that you were doing, but you were always very, very truthful and candid when people came and asked for advice. So I tried to instill that in my brand. And And yeah, you're right. If William definitely had come back and asked me for more advice, or Eric, or any of those guys, I certainly would have given it to him. But at the point where he found those 3 tenths, after me going to him and giving that to him, I was like, okay, I'll let him come to me next time.
Yeah, and again, well, I appreciate who you are as you've gone through the steps. And we're now into 2019, and you just ran your second Xfinity race. The first Xfinity race was on the oval at Iowa, and although you had some mechanical issues, I think you had a pretty good run there and were running in the top 15 or so speed-wise, so I think that's pretty strong. But going into Mid-Ohio, you gave me a call and said, hey, I need help. We need more spotters for Mid-Ohio. I was thrilled to go and to be on the radio with you and to go through that whole experience. It was a wild one. I think I've told you this, but I listen and watch just about every NASCAR race, and they have a great program where you can hear the spotters talk to the drivers and the crew chiefs. So here I am doing that every weekend, and I usually listen to guys, Josh Bylicky and some of those kind of guys who are ex-spec Miata guys and maybe don't have the best equipment. But I listen to the strategies and things just to try to develop my own belief. And it was really unique for me to go from, listening on NASCAR.com and doing all those things. Actually, I was sitting next to the Gibbs guys, spotter guys, talking over everything and doing stuff. So it was pretty unique for me to do it, and it was really fun to be there. Talk about Mid-Ohio a little bit and going into the race, what your expectations were, what your hopes were, and talk about the race a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. Like your experience there, Joe, it was pretty surreal for me to finally make that transition to a series where strategy really comes in, and you're always trying to play the field for any advantage you can find, as opposed to just it being a complete outright sprint race. I think that's what makes this level of racing so exciting, and there's so many different elements that people can take advantage of and or get screwed by or what have you. So when you are successful, even if you don't have the fastest car on the racetrack, but you're successful in strategizing and positioning yourself, it's a great feat. But as far as my second Xfinity race goes, I'm really happy that I had that experience at Iowa Speedway. Even though we had that mechanical failure, we still proved to be fast, so it gave me a little bit of boost of confidence. But then also, I had a familiarization with the series, with the people, with the level of competition, which is no joke, I will say. When you come from the K&N series and you jump up to Xfinity, especially towards the front half of the pack, those guys are on their game, like nobody's business. So, that was a really good thing to be experienced. So going into Mid-Ohio, I knew what to expect, and it was a weekend definitely not without drama, as most of those weekends typically are, especially at least with the level of experience that I have, the level of equipment that I was in, and not to say that we were in any bad stuff by any means, but it just, when you're not one of those Gibbs teams or somebody that is the championship caliber, things do go awry and stuff happens. But the first drama of the weekend, I could say, on track at least, was my dash caught on fire. And Joe, I know that when I was passing you out of turn two going into turn three and four, I believe, I started saying that the dash was smoking, and then, it caught on fire.
Yeah, I heard that on the radio, and I think all of us were just saying, find someone with the fire extinguisher. And exactly. if you didn't see it on NBC Sports on Friday of last week, they showed it because Will pulled up to a guy with a fire extinguisher, but the guy didn't know that the inside of the car was on fire. So Will unstrapped, got out of the car, grabbed the fire extinguisher, and put out his own fire. So there's some really funny social media about Will doing it all at the track, including putting out his own fire. So that was go ahead.
And you know where I learned that was from racing sports cars with you guys. If you're pretty much in sports car racing on your own, or you have to figure out how to overcome any of those little issues yourself. And if it's not you stepping up to the plate, there is going to be nobody else to handle it. So from all of those days in NASA and SCCA and such, they tell you when you have a problem, go straight to the flying stand, and that's what I did. And it makes for some pretty neat content. But the next practice, again, went not without drama. I ended up pushing pretty hard because we finally got comfortable, being that I only had about 25 laps on that racetrack, first time visiting Mid-Ohio. But started to really get a groove and understand what I had underneath me and what I needed to get in the car to be successful. And wouldn't you know it, I barrel it down into turn four and I wheel hop the crap out of it and end up sideways in China Beach with the nose tore off. So, went through that experience. I felt absolutely terrible because everybody, not only on my side of the business, but then the team side and everybody there at the racetrack, not only I wasted their time, but almost put all of their hard work to waste. But luckily, we got the car back. It was still in somewhat of one piece, and we were able to fix it back up that following evening and early in the morning the next day. So that was a little bit of a roller coaster to go through, and I'll be the first one to say that Maryland is down in China Beach was certainly my fault, and it's definitely a lesson that I've learned from, and I don't plan on doing it again. That was the beginning to Mid-Ohio for the weekend.
And, a shout out to the Brandon Built guys. They're the team that Will drove for. They had two cars. He drove one of the cars at Iowa, and he was in the main car for this race. And, those guys didn't know you very well, but they are really a good group of people just in general. They work hard. Doug, the crew chief, was really a calming force too. And in NASCAR it's a little bit different than sports cars. They close the garages at certain times and you're not allowed to work on their cars, so you can't really do an all-nighter like you can in sports cars, and that's an important thing for people to realize. So it kind of creates a bit of anxiety because you don't know if the car is going to be done for qualifying the next day. But they worked really hard and they did get it done for qualifying. I know you ended up 22nd in qualifying. The car wasn't perfect because they were really – I think we're the last car through tech to make it for qualifying. So the car wasn't perfect, but, you put it 22nd, which really wasn't bad. I know you were a little bit disappointed, not in the car or the crew or any of that, but just you wanted to be higher up qualifying. But you were you also understood what the team went through.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I always want to do better in something like qualifying, and I've always been a guy that not only races well, but I usually qualify pretty well. I'm not the best qualifier, but we're usually in the mix somewhere. And 22nd was a little bit of a disappointment, but at least we were ahead of some of the schools on the back of the pack, which was definitely a goal of ours. And I kept the car clean, and I think a big reason, why we didn't qualify better was I had the wreck from the day before in my mind, and I really said to myself, I'm going to keep this thing on the pavement. We're going to qualify conservatively. Again, was hoping better than 22nd, but that's where we ended up. We got to start the race we had the opportunity to start to execute our plan, and that was moving forward throughout the race. So that was definitely a good thing, I guess you could say, for our qualifying effort.
Yep, and so we went into the race, and, a lot of cars. There's 38 cars, I think there was, and starting 22nd, there's a bunch of ringers, road course ringers, they call them, and I don't think of Will as a road course ringer. I think Will's really good at road courses, but he's an oval guy, too. Jack Hawksworth, former IndyCar driver, GTG driver, came in to drive for Gibbs. You had AJ Allmendinger come in just for the road course races with colleague. You had some really top guys. Patrick Gallagher, we talked about, MX5 Cup champion. let's see, Lawson Ossenbach, who's a world challenge champion as well, was in the field. Chris Dyson. So there's a lot of good road course racers in there. And I think we started maybe second or third, third or fourth out of all the road course guys, and which wasn't bad. And then the race came, and talk about the race. What was it like, your first road course with Xfinity car?
Yeah, well, I can tell you the first stage, and those who aren't experienced with how NASCAR stages work, in the Xfinity series, there were three of them, and there's a certain amount of laps to take place, the first, second, and then third stage. But the first stage was honestly kind of miserable. starting 22nd, I didn't exactly, and obviously not being able to finish practice from the day before due to a wreck, I didn't know exactly the car that I would have underneath me. And I think we made up a few spots in the beginning of the race, and then throughout the run, as tires started falling off, we started falling off too. And I think I fell back to 22nd or even 23rd at some point. And that honestly is kind of a hopeless feeling, but I at least had a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel, knowing that we were going to have pit stops coming up, new tires are going to be put in the car, and we're going to be able to make adjustments. So I communicated that back to the crew and to Doug Randolph, who was crew chief on top of Fox, and he made some really good adjustments. So we were able to go back out there, and we ended up utilizing some of the cautions and stages to our benefit to, strategize and get towards the front of the field. So I think in the second stage, we were somewhere in the middle of the pack again, battling with some of those really good cars and then some of the really great road race guys, too. And still didn't necessarily struggle. We figured out some issues with the car, but really weren't able to advance. But towards the end of that stage, I think a lot of things kind of fell our way as far as cautions go and the way that other cars were kind of falling off around us. And we were able to pretty much flip the stage, from what I understand, and go to the front. So starting or somewhere in the middle of the final stage, we started on the front row alongside the 8 car of
Regan Smith.
I don't remember who it was. Regan Smith. So Regan Smith is a guy that's won Mid-Ohio before, and obviously he was in a really great piece of equipment. But got to battle with him a little bit up there before kind of the faster cars and the guys that are in the points playing championship passed us by. I didn't necessarily want to get in their way and, one, interrupt the points battle, two, get wrecked by one of those guys because they've got points in their mind. So kind of played it easy, was somewhat defensive, but also, passive when it came to letting them go and not either letting them rough me up or me rough them up. And ultimately, we fell back to 11th. And with three to go, I was being chased down by the 51 car, Jeremy Clements. And he was just a tick faster than me, and I think he was on the last lap that he passed. And we ended up finishing 12th. But, a lot of people that might not know NASCAR or the Xfinity Series specifically, when it comes to all the drivers, the teams, and everything that goes into it, they might think that, 12th place, that's not very good. But 12th for us is certainly a win. For the Brandonville Motorsports team, that was their best finish on a non-super speedway race, which is incredible. But then also for me, having my second start, and comparing our budget that we had for the weekend compared to everybody that finished in front of us, along with 5-6 cars that finished behind us, it was a feat in itself, and it's something that I think we all have to be super proud of. So, again, for 12th, I'm pretty happy with it.
Yeah, you beat some really good cars, and it was very, very impressive to see.
Yeah, it felt really good. Very, very good to beat some of those guys.
And I will say that Doug Randolph and the Brandonville crew did some really creative things, so that it was actually the last restart of the race, you were on the front row. You can't put anybody in a better position than that. And you kind of play it off like you gave in and gave, let people by. Well, you weren't. I mean, Bell had to bump you three or four times to try to get through. And it was just close racing. It wasn't malicious. But there were some top guys who were working their butts off. You were not, you know, you held Cindric back for two laps, the guy who ended up winning the race. So you're battling your rear end off. So at any rate, you know, you're doing the best you could with the equipment that you had. And, you know, we were trying to guide you the best we could as well. We avoided some craziness, some wrecks, some other stuff that gave me quite a few heart attacks.
You helped calm me down too, Joe. A lot of people won't know what we're talking about, but Joe and I have a connection where when we're on the radio with each other, he's able to help me hone in and focus on what's important and, stay focused, I guess.
Yeah, and I think Jeremy Clements, he actually passed you with two to go, and you did not want to give it up.
Okay.
And I actually had to kind of talk you into it because I didn't think it was worth it, and I thought he was going to send you back into China Beach. So I don't know if you remember that in the back straight. I just said, well, it's not worth it. Let him go. And you did. And, a 12th place finish was a great finish.
Yep, definitely.
So, Will, what's the future? What's your next thing happening for you?
Well, that's kind of up in the air other than one race that for certain, and that is that we'll be racing at the Charlotte Roval September 28th in the Xfinity Series for my third start, or the third official start, and really looking forward to that one. Obviously, it's not a traditional road course, so it's going to be interesting to experience, especially if this series. I've got a few laps around that place in the Miata, luckily, but I have a feeling it's going to be similar to last year. There'll be a little bit of a bumper cars battle, maybe even similar to what we experienced this past week in the Mid-Ohio. But the lulls are certainly closer at Charlotte, so that's something I'm anticipating and really looking forward to, but also really trying to figure out how I'm gonna approach it. But that's kind of the immediate future. Otherwise, for 2020, I'm trying to go piece together a full season of the NASCAR Xfinity Series at team like Brandon Built Motorsports, a group that's definitely not championship caliber at the moment, but they're showing a lot of hard work, and their results have actually been really great. For the amount of time they've been competing in the series and the amount of resource they have, it's pretty impressive. So trying to piece together a ride like that would be great for my career to follow. Kind of footsteps guys like Ross Chastain, Ryan Preece, guys that really, really race with these lower teams to gain the experience and a little bit of the reputation. But then when they had the opportunity to jump in A-plus equipment like a Joe Gibbs or a JRM or a Penske, they instantly won. So that's something that I'm trying to go after and I'm trying to strategize with my career.
Well, I feel very lucky to have been a part of your career. I look forward to helping any way I can in the future. I'm very excited for you, and I love the fact that you came through the TC America series, and I hope it helps other people relate to, if you work hard at it and you really put your mind to it, you can achieve all sorts of different things. So, Will, I'm proud of you, and I look forward to working with you again in the future. And thanks for taking the time to come on and reliving your roots with TC America and the TC America podcast. Thanks so much, Will.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Joe. I really appreciate it. Good working with you. And any of those TC car owners that are listening to this, hey, if you got an open seat, you want a NASCAR Xfinity Series driver to come wheel your car, I'm all yours.
I love it, Will. Always looking. Always putting the word out there.
Always looking.
Yeah. Thanks again, Will. We'll see you in a few weeks.
Sounds good. Thanks, Joe.
Take care. Hi, my name is Corksport, and I'm a functioning Mazdaholic. It started in the golden.com days, slinging parts across seas, hanging out in the garage. One thing led to another, and we kept saying, this could be better if we did this. That's how it always starts, with the one small thing that needs to be fixed, with something that could always be better in one way or another. The next thing I knew, I was slinging go-fast Mazda bits left and right, and somewhere along the way ended up with race cars hanging out in my garage. Now it's time to take those cars out of the garage and get back in the game. We'll see you at the track. Love, Corksport.
Thanks for listening to the Touring Car America podcast, where touring car racing comes to life. Please like, and subscribe to the show. And for more series information, go to the series website at tcamerica.us.